Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Stanford historians James Sheehan and David Kennedy for the Cold War and its legacies, exploring the global impact of this pivotal era. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
All that's going to change is who pays for it. Does the federal government pay for it, or do individuals pay for it?
Health insurance takes center stage on Capitol Hill this week. But are there ways to actually make the cost of care cheaper? For Sunday, December 7th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Miles Parks. The clock is ticking for lawmakers as healthcare premiums are set to spike next month for millions of Americans. And Lionel Messi just won a Major League Soccer title.
He continues to be what he's been for his entire career, which is alien-like.
Is American soccer having its Caitlin Clark moment? Also, does it feel like there's a lot of history on TV these days? Presidential historian Alexis Coe says there's a reason for that.
We have this race to define our collective memory, to say who we were, who we are, and who we're going to be.
First News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Janine Hurst. Qatar, a key mediator between Hamas and Israel, says formal negotiations still haven't begun for the next phase of the Gaza ceasefire. NPR's Daniel Estrin has more from Doha, Qatar.
One last Israeli hostage body needs to be handed over from Hamas to Israel, and then the ceasefire's second phase can begin, says Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. That phase would include Hamas laying down its weapons and Israeli troops withdrawing. But Majid al-Ansari, advisor to the Prime Minister of Qatar, told reporters talks haven't started yet.
I cannot tell you that these talks will begin tomorrow. I can't tell you they will begin next week. But the communication that is taking place between all the parties is based on applying pressure in order to move to stage two.
He said the Trump administration is applying pressure on Israel to move forward on the ceasefire. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Doha, Qatar.
The suspect accused of planting pipe bombs near the U.S. Capitol in 2021 told federal investigators he believed conspiracy theories that the 2020 election was stolen from then-President Trump. He also expressed views supportive of Trump. And Piers Mara Lyson reports the account comes from a person familiar with the investigation who wasn't authorized to speak publicly.
For years, Trump supporters, including Dan Bongino, who is now the deputy FBI director, have claimed that the pipe bombs were an inside job. But the suspect was apparently a Trump supporter who told law enforcement that he believed the lie that Trump won the 2020 election. Speaking to Sean Hannity on Fox, Bongino explained why the facts are at odds with what he used to say as a paid podcaster.
I was paid in the past, Sean, for my opinions. That's clear. And one day I'll be back in that space. But that's not what I'm paid for now.
Now Bongino says, quote, I'm paid to be your deputy FBI director, and we base investigations on facts. Mara Lyason, NPR News.
Policymakers at the Federal Reserve meet this week to talk about interest rates. And Pierre Scott Horsley reports the central bank is expected to lower its benchmark rate by a quarter percentage point.
The Fed lowered interest rates at each of its last two meetings, but policymakers were divided on whether a third straight cut would be warranted this coming week. Inflation still well above the Fed's 2% target, which would ordinarily suggest keeping rates higher. But the central bank's also concerned about a softening job market, which could be cushioned with lower interest rates. Investors think those job market worries will take priority at this week's meeting, and the rate-setting committee will opt for another quarter-point cut, but the decision is not likely to be unanimous. The six-week government shutdown added to the uncertainty by delaying some key economic reports until after this week's meeting. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
U.S. futures contracts are trading in mixed territory at this hour. You're listening to NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Rachel Vasquez. Barry Bonds has lost another chance to make it into the Baseball Hall of Fame. According to the results released this evening, fewer than five people on a 16-member panel voted in favor of Bonds. He needed 12 to be inducted. The legendary former Giant slugger holds the records for most career home runs at 762, most home runs in a season at 73, and was voted National League MVP seven times. Despite his accolades, Bonds' career was controversial amid accusations he used performance-enhancing drugs, and after he was convicted of obstruction of justice in Major League Baseball's steroid scandal. That conviction was overturned on appeal. Bonds has been considered for the Hall of Fame 11 times prior to this, each time coming up short. Former Giants player Jeff Kent was voted in today and will be inducted into the Hall of Fame in July. Transit advocates in San Francisco are rallying support for a local parcel tax measure that would help fund Muni. SFMTA is facing a more than $300 million budget deficit, and advocates say this progressive tax, which they've dubbed the Muni Forever proposal, would help fill the gap. Shia French is with Senior and Disability Action, which is helping promote the measure.
The service we have right now is not enough, and also when we go to voters, we need to be saying, if you vote for this, things will improve, not things will be worse.
French says the effort would work in tandem with a separate proposed regional tax measure in order to avoid transit service cuts across the Bay Area. Supporters plan to rally tomorrow in front of San Francisco City Hall. I'm Rachel Vasquez, KQED News.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing about the state of housing in America on the After the Fact podcast, available at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. And support comes from you, the listeners and supporters and members of KQED. Do you know about Close All Tabs? That's the KQED Tech Podcast. And this week you can learn about what happened to Purple Moon Games, a conversation with the company's founder about its impact on girls in tech and how it all came to an abrupt end. Find that story and more in your podcast feed, Close All Tabs. We're expecting more clouds and fog tonight and chilly temperatures.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Miles Parks in Washington, D.C. This week, the Senate is set to vote on healthcare subsidies with a looming deadline. 24 million Americans use Affordable Care Act marketplaces for their health insurance, and they need to pick a plan by December 15th. But those shoppers right now are caught in limbo, not knowing what they're going to pay. Amy Jackson from Butler, Missouri, is one of them. She spoke recently with NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin about her health insurance costs with and without an ACA subsidy.
Right now, it's closer to $300. However, if you don't count the tax credit, it goes to $1,250.
And do you have an extra $1,000 a month?
No, I really don't.
So, where is this headed? For that, let's bring in NPR's Luke Garrett, who's been monitoring the rumblings on Capitol Hill. Hi, Luke.
Hey, Miles.
So, tell us what the Senate is voting on this week.
So, the Senate is expected to vote on a Democratic proposal to extend the ACA tax credits for 3 years. This would keep prices relatively the same for folks like Amy Jackson. Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says the vote will be on Thursday, and he's calling it the GOP's, quote, last chance to prevent what he calls, quote, skyrocketing premiums.
But Schumer is the minority leader. Why is he determining when a vote like this happens?
Right. So do you remember when the moderate Democrats made that deal to reopen the government after the longest shutdown in history?
Yeah, of course.
So in that deal, Democrats negotiated for a vote on the ACA in early December. And we're here. Schumer is picking up this 3-year extension legislation as that vote. And the problem for Democrats is, you know, even with this vote, they're still going to need a few Republicans, that is, to join them for the 60-vote threshold.
So what are Republicans saying about the idea of this 3-year extension on the ACA subsidies?
Senate Majority Leader John Thune told reporters last week that Schumer's plan is just not realistic for the GOP caucus. Here's Republican Senator Dave McCormick of Pennsylvania on Fox News this morning.
The Democrats are engaged in theater right now. They're putting forward this week a 3-year extension of those subsidies from COVID.
But McCormick did stress that Congress needs to figure out a solution for ACA premium costs that are really going to go up.
I do think we need to address this issue, particularly for working families. So I'd be in favor of some sort of limited extension that reformed those subsidies.
So, Miles, there is a growing, you know, momentum within the GOP caucus for some sort of Band-Aid solution on these expiring ACA subsidies, but no consensus has been reached.
Well, President Trump obviously has a lot of sway with congressional Republicans. Has he weighed in at all on this?
So President Trump has remained relatively hands-off, chiming in occasionally on his social media platform. His policy message has remained critical of the ACA, and Trump has instead suggested sending money to American health saving accounts. Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana tells Fox News he's working to turn Trump's idea into bill text as soon as today.
We're working to deliver to Speaker Leader Thune and Speaker Johnson a plan which I think could get 60 votes, which gives the American people the power, and they can choose a lower premium and an HSA. We're working on that, and I'll give them a piece of paper probably by email tonight.
But Miles, I asked the White House today whether, you know, they've reviewed this, quote, piece of paper Cassidy's referring to and Cassidy's efforts. In a statement, spokesman Kush Desai, you know, did not comment on Cassidy's legislation directly or the ACA extensions. Instead, Desai said the health care system is just not working and, quote, the president has instead focused on lowering prescription drug costs by hammering out deals with pharmaceutical companies.
Okay, so as we head into next week, what else are you watching?
In short, GOP leader John Thune, last week he told reporters that Republicans will have a plan, which we have still yet to see. But even with the majority, Thune will need Democratic help. And those same moderate senators who sided with Republicans to reopen the government are the ones to watch. But again, even if they strike a deal in the Senate, the GOP-controlled House will also have to pass it, and Trump would have to sign it. But looming over all this, Miles, is the big motivating factor of, you know, growing dissatisfaction with rising costs. And that force could inspire bipartisan healthcare legislation or launch, you know, a political blame game on Capitol Hill.
That is NPR's Luke Garrett. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So as we just heard, the debate over extending the Affordable Care Act subsidies is intensifying this week. Millions of people's premiums are set to jump at the end of the year. But economist Craig Garthwaite wants the U.S. to think bigger when it comes to healthcare. He's a co-author of a new study called Coverage Isn't Care. It argues for fairly simple solutions that don't just paper over problems with the current system.
It's a frustrating thing, I think, for economists as we watch this debate where, you know, they're saying if the subsidies expire or they don't, it'll change the cost of healthcare. That's not true. All that's going to change is who pays for it. Does the federal government pay for it or do individuals pay for it? And while that's an important question, it doesn't get at what I think we do care about, which is how much are we spending on healthcare overall and how much care are people actually getting for the money that we're spending?
His research comes from the Aspen Economic Strategy Group, and he's also the director of the Program on Healthcare at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. Professor Garthwaite joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So your paper says it offers a roadmap for structural reforms to America's healthcare system that would make healthcare more affordable. The first of these recommendations is to ease restrictions on doctors who have been trained in other countries. Can you explain how that would work?
Yeah, I mean, the idea would be that we want to increase the supply of people who can provide medical services. With if we have more people who are intentionally coming here with the goal of treating low-income Americans, it'll provide more access and ideally lower costs. There is a readily available set of people who have graduated from reputable, credentialed medical schools abroad who could come here, and we could develop programs that say we will, in exchange for you coming to the United States and being allowed to work here as a physician, you have to primarily concentrate on targeting low-income patients, and in particular patients who are on Medicaid, which is our nation's insurance program for the low-income and the disabled.
Is there any risk, I guess, in terms of people who receive this coverage, you know, having the care being different for people who are lower income versus higher income?
The first thing to recognize is we already have different levels of care or different sites of care for people who are lower income or higher income in the United States. Lower income individuals are often going to clinics that concentrate on them. The vast majority of individuals on Medicaid are treated in facilities that primarily concentrate on low income individuals. And so what we want to do is recognize that reality and provide the most efficient way to get people access to care. With the idea being that perhaps the biggest problem that low-income Americans face is not that they get a different level of care, it's that they're unable to find care at all.
So this study also mentions the idea of expanding the pool of providers by allowing nurse practitioners and physician assistants to practice independently. Can you explain that bit of it a little bit more?
Yeah, so we have a ready-made set of providers, these mid-level providers who have advanced training. They are not doctors in the sense that they have an MD or a DO degree, but they've gone through a lot of advanced training. And for a lot of primary care, research has shown that they provide exceptional care for individuals. In addition, they are a lower cost input that can be more readily deployed across the healthcare ecosystem. You can often spend more time with a mid-level provider than you can with a doctor. And for primary care, I think that's often what people want. They want to be able to sit down and talk to a doctor about the things that are concerning them. And so this can, again, augment the healthcare workforce. We see a lot of use of mid-level providers among practices that are already engaged in what we refer to as value-based care. Right, but practices that are trying to, you know, make more money by making people healthier. And we think that there's a real place for that in the Medicaid and low-income population.
Can I ask broadly about these changes? I mean, how radical are some of these changes, or are there ways or levers in place already to allow for some of these changes to more easily be applied?
In many ways, certainly on the idea of foreign-trained doctors and mid-level providers, we already have experience with various kinds of programs that have different residency requirements or different what are referred to as scope of practice laws for the mid-level provider, kind of dictating, you know, how much prescribing behavior might they have independently. So we're really talking about expanding sort of an existing set of tools, but really targeting it on a population where we know there is an identifiable need for more access to care. And I think that's where Tim Layton is my co-author on this, where we started with this, which is the title of the paper, which is Coverage Isn't Care. There's so much discussion, so much of the debate we're going to have in Congress over the next 2 weeks is going to be about insurance coverage, which is good, but it's a necessary but not sufficient condition for getting access to healthcare. And I think we'd like to see the debate focus more on what actually gets people care. And that has to be a supply side conversation where we think about who's providing the care, and not just what economists refer to as the demand side of conversation, which is who's paying for the care.
I don't want to be cynical. I hate being the cynical voice here. But I guess when you look at the current landscape in Congress, how realistic is it that they would take on some of these things as opposed to the sort of tweaks that they're negotiating to the current system right now?
Well, you're talking to an economist, so you can't be more cynical than I am. I think I've lost almost all faith in the idea that Congress will do good government and pass laws anymore. The nice thing about this, though, is that a number of the things that we're talking about here can actually be accomplished at the state level. And we have seen state governments be more active, but Medicaid, it's important to recognize, is a program that, while it's jointly funded by the state and the federal government, it is administered at the state level. And through waivers and other processes, state Medicaid agencies actually can obtain a lot of flexibility to implement these. And I actually think that's a wonderful thing about America. It's what we thought about, you know, the founders thought about for the country, is let's let all these states experiment, right? They become, as we often refer to, as the laboratories of democracy. Here they can be the laboratories of low-income coverage and figure out what's the best way to provide true access to healthcare for low-income Americans.
And your paper basically is arguing, like, if we fix some of the broader issues here, then the actual cost of healthcare could go down.
Yes, and if the actual cost of healthcare goes down, we can provide care to far more people more efficiently. And that's ultimately what we want. We as a society want people to get access to the healthcare they need, and we should focus on providing that in the most cost-efficient manner.
That's Craig Garthwaite of Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for KQED comes from John Murray Health, delivering cardiac surgery in a patient-first approach and minimally invasive techniques in the East Bay at John Muir Health. And European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com. Tiny Desk Radio coming up tonight.
I'm Ana Maria Serra. Next time on Tiny Desk Radio, the sextet known as Y Music. Experimental pop from Julia Holter. Plus, visionary songs of love from Georgia Ann Muldrow. That's next time on Tiny Desk Radio from NPR Music.
Tiny Desk Radio at 8 o'clock tonight, following Hidden Brain at 7, ahead on KQED News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. 3 days of talks between the U.S. and Ukrainian negotiators wrapped up in Florida with no major breakthrough. Ukrainian President Zelensky is set to talk with European Union leaders tomorrow about terms of a peace deal. President Trump is angry with Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar of Texas for not switching parties after he pardoned both the congressman and his wife, who were charged with bribery and money laundering. Cuellar thanked Trump but registered to run for re-election as a Democrat. Trump says that shows a lack of loyalty. And at the weekend box office, Five Nights at Freddy's 2 debuted in the top spot with an estimated $63 million in ticket sales. The sequel cost a reported $36 million to produce. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Arm, committed to delivering innovative advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm, arm.com. And Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And support comes from you, the listeners and supporters and members of KQED Public Radio. I'm Beth Huizinga. Thanks for being here. It's 520.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Miles Parks. Major League Soccer, or MLS, may have just had its Caitlin Clark moment. Yesterday, Lionel Messi, one of the biggest stars in the world, led his team Inter Miami to its first ever MLS Cup championship on national television. MLS has been fighting to break into the national spotlight for years. So could this be the moment that the league was waiting for? Paul Tenorio of The Athletic has been following Messi since he came to America in 2023, and he was at the MLS final yesterday. He joins us now. Paul Tenorio, welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Messi's obviously a household name all over the world, but he is 38 now. Can you tell us a little bit about how important his play was both in the championship game yesterday and to Miami's season more broadly?
Yeah, well, he continues to be what he's been for his entire career, which is alien-like, extraordinary, all season long. And he is expected to be named MVP for the second consecutive season in Major League Soccer. He had 29 goals, which led the league. He had 19 assists, and that includes in yesterday's championship game. He played a part in all three goals. Messi worked a little bit of magic in between three different defenders to get free and play a ball in that eventually led to the goals.
I have to be honest, some of those numbers you just mentioned are kind of crazy, but I'm kind of surprised that the season-long numbers haven't kind of gotten more into the mainstream. Do you have any thoughts on why Messi's season hasn't been more of a mainstream thing this year?
Well, I mean, I think this is a big part of the struggle for Major League Soccer. They resonate quite strongly within their own fan base. The attendance at games around the nation is strong. People who are diehard fans of Major League Soccer will tune in and watch and read anything about the league, but they haven't really been able to break into the mainstream, at least over the course of an entire season. There are leagues from all over the world which are accessible to American fans, whether it's NBC in the Premier League or Champions League on CBS or Liga MX, which remains the most popular league on television in the United States. MLS hasn't quite carved out that audience. And with Messi specifically, it's been tougher because they've been behind a paywall on Apple TV. And that's really hurt them in terms of growing audience.
That makes a lot of sense. So Inter Miami signed Messi to this 2.5-year contract, estimated at something like $150 million. What are they hoping comes with that contract in addition to just his performance on the field?
I think they are hoping with Lionel Messi staying in Major League Soccer that it extends their ability to capitalize on the fans that Messi brings into the league. You know, I wrote a book called The Messi Effect, which comes out on June 9th, and it is about that exact conundrum that the league faces. Messi is not the easy button. He doesn't just make you popular right away. What he represents, though, is opportunity. There are people who tuned in to yesterday's MLS Cup to watch Messi win an MLS Cup, not to watch Inter Miami win. And now the league has to do something with it. They are making changes, MLS is. They've changed the calendar beginning in 2027. They'll flip from a annual calendar to one that will closely align with the top European leagues. It'll run from July through May instead. They are in discussions to change the roster rules so that teams can spend more. The key there is that they need to turn those fans into higher media ratings so that they can get a bigger media deal. That's the lifeblood of sports in today's economy.
That's The Athletic's Paul Tenorio. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
The U.S. is reviewing its ties with Tanzania after what it calls disturbing violence that killed hundreds of protesters following the East African country's disputed October election. Tanzania's president called the deadly unrest an attempted coup. Emmanuel Gunza reports from neighboring Kenya.
We need to put a closure to this as a family. We are tortured emotionally, psychologically.
Celestine Odor is pleading for the return of her brother's body.
Things can't move on. We are tortured. We are appealing for the body of John.
John Odor, a Kenyan teacher, was killed in Dar es Salaam on October 29th, the day of Tanzania's disputed elections.
John was not found. His body was not found. Not even the body of those people they were killed with.
Since then, the family's appeals to authorities have been met with silence. Odor is one of hundreds of protesters feared killed when security forces crushed demonstrations over President Samia Suluhu Hassan's widely disputed election in October, which she claims to have won 98% of the vote. More than a month later, his family can't bring his body home for burial, says their lawyer Abner Mango.
His family do not have a big request. They do not even care about what was happening in Tanzania. All they want is the body of their kin.
Tanzania, long seen as one of East Africa's most stable countries, hasn't seen violence like this in decades. Independent verification of facts on the ground remains difficult, with many people too afraid to speak publicly. Human rights groups say the full toll is only now coming to light after the government shut down the internet, imposed a curfew, and barred media from reporting. Hassan, who rose to power in 2021 after the death of former President John Magufuli, had initially been praised as a reformer. But critics say the post-election crackdown marks a dramatic reversal of her early promises. In a first public response last week, she pushed back against the allegations, calling the unrest an orchestrated attempt to overthrow her administration. What happened was a manufactured event, she told the crowd. This unrest was part of a broader project with malicious intent, involving people who knew exactly what they were doing, those who didn't, and others paid to join in. President Hassan also defended the police response. When people say they used excessive force, what were they supposed to do? Sit and wait for a coup to unfold, she asked. The opposition denies plotting to overthrow the state. They accuse the government of using the violence as a pretext for a sweeping crackdown and arresting dozens of protesters, while many remain missing.
There are disturbing reports that hundreds of protesters and other people have been killed and an unknown number injured or detained.
The United Nations Human Rights Office says hundreds may have died. Saif Magango is spokesperson for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights.
Security forces have been seen removing bodies from streets and hospitals and taking them to undisclosed locations in an apparent attempt to conceal evidence.
International pressure is mounting. The European Union has frozen tens of millions in aid, and the US has issued new travel warnings and a review of its ties. The crisis may yet deepen. Nationwide protests are planned for December 9th, with solidarity demonstrations in Nairobi, London and Washington.
I don't know. We have made so many efforts. I've struggled.
Back in Kenya, the Odor family still waits for John's body.
As the firstborn of this family, it has not been easy. It is so heavy.
Every day without answers is another day of anguish, a cruel reminder of lives lost in the crackdown. For NPR News, I'm Emmanuel Gunza in Nairobi.
Off the top of your head, how many movies or TV shows can you think of where there's a portrayal of a U.S. president? I think I can probably do 10, maybe 15. It might be the only genre that's more flooded than the Marvelverse. But there is a new addition to this list, a new series on Netflix called Death by Lightning. This one, though, gives the spotlight to one of the country's lesser-known leaders, James Garfield, the 20th U.S. president who was shot 4 months into his presidency. For more on death by lightning and to talk politicians on the big and small screens, we're joined by presidential historian Alexis Coe. She's a senior fellow at the New America Think Tank and the author of a best-selling biography of George Washington. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you for having me.
So I have to ask, how excited were you when you found out that there was a miniseries that was coming out about a U.S. president that was not Abraham Lincoln or Richard Nixon? I feel like those guys get all the airtime.
They really do. And Garfield and Chester A. Arthur, his successor, rarely get any attention. They're a hard sell even when I've got people in the room and they're excited to hear about lesser known presidents and anecdotes they haven't heard before. Their eyes kind of glaze over.
I want to dig into the president a little bit in the portrayal of Garfield here, because he's portrayed as this high character family man, a war hero who basically has the Republican nomination thrust upon him. Can you talk a little bit more about what he was like? Because if listeners are like me, I am not really familiar with James Garfield.
James Garfield was at the 1880 convention to stump for someone else. And so it's interesting that he is able to sway them in this way, because he is, of course, known. He fought in the Civil War. He served in Congress. But he was not a big part of the party machine that controlled politics at the time. In the 1880s, the country was living in the aftermath of the Civil War. So Reconstruction had ended, federal protections were withdrawn, white supremacists were controlling the South, and it wasn't really fully dismantled, but it reasserted itself sort of openly. And so the Republican Party, Garfield is a part of it, but he's not a part of the patronage machine. There are bosses who treated government jobs like private spoils. And corruption wasn't so much a scandal in the way we think of it. It wasn't like Watergate. It was standard operating procedure. And therefore, someone like Garfield, who had taught classics, he's not really at the forefront of everyone's mind.
I want to dig in a little bit to the man who shot him, who's also a main character of this series, Charles Guiteau, who's played by actor Matthew McFadden. There is something pretty uniquely American about this guy. He is sort of a grifter, a little bit of a kind of career liar, but he also has high aspirations for himself. What did you make of McFadden's portrayal of the assassin?
McFadden did a great job of conveying what we would see today in what's known as incels, in these articles about men who feel adrift and who want to be engaged, and they view themselves in these stories as heroes, but they're not really doing much to apply themselves or entering society in a way that contributes or presents them with those kinds of situations in which they can rise to the top. So we have someone like Guiteau who sees Garfield, recognizes greatness, and thinks to himself, if this guy can get in, so can I. And of course, that catapults him in his mind as a major player. And we see throughout the series people telling him he's not.
I mean, do you also think there's something resonant here specifically with the rise in political violence and violent rhetoric in our politics?
So much about the series felt like it applied to the present. One of the issues was political violence. We saw how it can happen in an instant, how it can't be anticipated. There are people who seem to be really consistent in their lives as far as their views. There are people who seem inconsistent. You can't really know when someone's going to act. I think the feeling, though, the passion, was what connects throughout the eras.
Have you noticed, I mean, it feels like with Ken Burns' documentary about the Revolutionary War also coming out recently, that there is a wave of interest in this sort of historical content. Do you feel like there's more interest in content right now looking back at the American past than maybe in previous years?
I think there's a hunger to understand how we got to this place that feels so divisive. It also has to do with our 250th. America will soon turn 250. And so we have this race to define our collective memory, to say who we were, who we are, and who we're going to be. So that resonates. But I think in particular, the world of 1880 seems closer both on the timeline and when we look at what we see in this series. It's more than we'd like to believe. Americans then were exhausted by corruption and inequality was exploding. The political system felt captured. I feel that way now. So when Garfield stands up and insists that a conscience should matter more than machinery, I think it really resonated because people are starved for integrity.
Is there anybody else who maybe I haven't heard of who should get a Netflix miniseries, a figure in American history who you're kind of like, they could hold a 4-episode, 8-episode series who you would like to see made who maybe isn't super famous?
I would love to say all, because that's honestly how I feel. As much as I'm happy that Garfield and his moment, those 4 months in office and the incredible speech that got him there, is now reinserted into our collective memory, I'm a little sad we don't see what Chester A. Arthur did next.
All right. Well, Netflix has their work cut out for them. Presidential historian Alexis Coe, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The last public execution in the United States happened less than a century ago in Kentucky. Rainey Bethea, a black man accused of raping a white woman, was hanged in 1936. Now, his death is at the center of a new book. From the Appalachia and Mid-South newsroom, Derek Operly has this story. And a warning, this story does include descriptions of racist violence.
Bill Shelton painted a shocking picture of the scene from Rainey Bethea's hanging.
Everybody went. Everybody had a wonderful time. And it was over just like that.
That's from a 2013 Davis County Public Library interview Shelton gave before his death. In it, he remembers the festive atmosphere, the sea of people gathered around the scaffolding as Bethea walked calmly to his death.
They came from everywhere. And there was hawkers. They sold sandwiches and they sold Coca-Colas. And you'd have thought it was a big picnic or something.
In her new book, American Bloodlines, Reckoning with Lynch Culture, Owensboro native Sonia Lee examines the 1936 case through court records, contemporary reporting, and her own family history. Lee was inspired to look into the case after learning her grandparents attended the hanging as newlyweds, and in her research, she learned she was related to the prosecuting attorney. She says it's made her think harder about racial violence.
There's just so many things layered up where things could have been different for Rainey Bethea. But at the same time, we can start to see the connections how racial violence is still evident in our communities.
On a summer morning in 1936, a 70-year-old white woman named Elza Edwards was found dead in her Owensboro home. A local doctor determined she'd been strangled and raped, and 2 days later, authorities shifted the investigation to Bethea, a black man in his 20s who Edwards had hired to work in her home. The prosecution used Bethea's fingerprints found in the room he was paid to clean. They were not on the victim's body. Lee says the evidence against Bethea was flimsy.
One of the things that we can do through this case is to look and see how it might have been possible that justice would have been done. And that just takes a little bit of curiosity.
Bethea was charged only with rape, not murder. That's because they wanted to use an archaic Kentucky law that punished convicted rapists with public hanging.
They brought an old law out of hiding so that they could then try for rape alone and hang.
A murder charge would have carried a sentence of death by electric chair. After just 4.5 minutes of deliberation by an all-white jury, Bethea was found guilty. His defense counsel called no witnesses and delivered no closing argument. A little more than 2 months passed between Edward's death and Bethea's hanging, and in the run-up, a media circus descended on the town. Public hangings had been common in the U.S. in the 1800s, but by the 1930s, they'd been on the decline for decades, as attitudes changed and many states started to have executions in private by gas chamber or by electric chair. So this rare public spectacle in 1936 drew around 20,000 people. Today, there is no historical marker on the riverfront where Bethea was executed. That's something Rondalyn Randolph has been wanting to do for more than a decade. She's the president of the local NAACP and leads the Owensboro Community Remembrance Project.
It shows a respect to Rainey's humanity. It shows that our community is not that community anymore, and we're able to move forward by doing, you know, the right thing.
Sensational nationwide coverage of Bethia's public hanging embarrassed many in Kentucky, leading the state to ban the practice 2 years later. For NPR News, I'm Derek Operly in Owensboro, Kentucky.
This is NPR News.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, we travel down to South Georgia to spend 48 hours at El Refugio. It's a refuge for people visiting detainees at one of the country's largest immigration detention camps.
Every weekend that I come down here, I play up different scenarios in my mind about what could possibly happen.
That's next time on Latino USA.
Latino USA is coming your way at 6 o'clock this evening. And that's in about 20 minutes. And then Hidden Brain at 7.
In the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, a movie that had been released years earlier became a surprise hit. It was a film about a global pandemic.
On the Warner Brothers catalog, I think it was ranked 270. And it had shot up to being the second most popular movie on the catalog overnight.
Why we're drawn to dark and scary stories, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Hidden Brain at 7 o'clock this evening here on KQED News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. The Supreme Court hears arguments tomorrow over whether President Trump has the power to oust leaders of independent agencies. Federal law shields regulators from politics. Trump fired FTC Commissioner Rebecca Slaughter in March. She sued, and a lower court agreed with her. A federal judge has dealt a setback to Justice Department efforts to seek a new indictment against former FBI Director James Comey this weekend, temporarily barring prosecutors from using evidence they'd relied on when they initially secured criminal charges. But it doesn't stop the government from trying again. And in college football playoff rankings, Alabama and Miami are in, Notre Dame is out, and Indiana is the number one in the rankings 12-team bracket. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
In the next segment of All Things Considered, a new book, and also the question of if a director wins an Academy Award, how does it shape his next film, his or her next film? Support for NPR comes from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for chefs and designed for restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. And the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing about the state of housing in America on the After the Fact podcast, available at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. And support comes from you, the listeners and supporters and members of KQED.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Miles Parks. Okay, I want to level with you here. I am not really a royals person. I've watched maybe a half season of The Crown. I barely know who Meghan Markle is, but I do love a good love story. And while the book we're about to talk about is technically a novel about English royalty, it's also about a question that comes up no matter who you are. What would you give up for love? Your job? The place you live? How about the chance to be the Queen of England? It's this tension that's at the heart of the new novel, The Heir Apparent. The heroine is Lexi Villiers. She's a member of the British royal family who leaves that life behind to become a doctor in Tasmania.
Her mother dies in a mysterious boat accident when Lexi is 17. And that event changes her from trying to be the most perfect aristocratic girl in the world to suddenly rethinking everything. And she moves to the other side of the world and she begins a new life in Australia.
On the verge of completing her residency, tragedy strikes her family again. And suddenly, Lexi is heir apparent to the English throne. Author Rebecca Armitage, who spent years reporting on royal families for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, told me she was fascinated by the social experiment that is the modern monarchy.
If you were King Henry VIII, your role is pretty clear because you're the head of government, you're a tyrant, you can do whatever you want, you're England. But these days, there are some slight constitutional responsibilities, but it's largely just symbolic, and you are a tourism draw card, and so there must come a point where you have all this attention and all this pressure on you, but what really is the purpose of your life beyond being a symbol of a nation? You know, I would never want to be royal myself. I was just really interested in the state of royalty where you're told that you're better than everyone. Like, they try to say that that's not how they feel, but that is the state of royalty, is being told that you are above everyone else. But also, what is your purpose in life? I just think that would do something really interesting to your brain.
Well, it also felt like the experience for Lexi is so present in this book that she is a woman. And I think I felt kind of naive reading it because I was reading it and I was telling my wife, I was like, my God, like there is so much eating disorder stuff happening both with her and with her mother. I mean, she talks about when she does end up leaving the royal family, that is like one of the first things she realizes that she can kind of eat in a way that she wants to, or in a way that is not, doesn't feel so controlled. Was that something that was present as you were thinking about writing this book, that theme specifically?
Yeah, because I mean, every character in the book has a real life counterpart. So she's very loosely inspired by Harry, but I deliberately made her a woman because I wanted to explore what it's like to have a female body that is on public display. And obviously we know that Diana really struggled under that spotlight. She lost, you know, a huge amount of weight. She struggled with eating disorders for much of her youth purely because of the intensity of that spotlight and the tabloid focus on their bodies. I really wanted to explore, you know, girls are told from birth. We watch Disney movies. We're told that there's no greater thing than being a princess. But what is the actual reality of that? And I think the intense pressure to be physically perfect must just be absolutely crushing at times.
And I just want to just make it clear for listeners, this book is also just very, very fun. Like there are these themes that are explored in all these different ways, but in some ways it almost feels like a normal rom-com in a lot of the flashbacks because we have Lexi not in the royal life, kind of in Australia, having this fling with her coworker at one instance and kind of also having this long budding romance with Jack, who's a winemaker in Australia. And then that's kind of juxtaposed against this fairy tale life that she jumps back into. But it does explore also the question of healthy romantic relationships. And I guess I wonder whether that was something you were thinking about. It seems to me like Lexi is almost struggling with whether it is possible at all to have a healthy romantic relationship under these circumstances.
I think the thing with Lexi is at the beginning of the book, she has a lot of trauma, unacknowledged trauma. I really think she's got PTSD at the beginning of the novel. And she has this terrible fear of unconditional love because the only person she's experienced that from is her mother. And then she lost her mother. So she feels like she can't ever reach for it again because the pain of losing it is too much. So in the novel, yeah, there is a friends to lovers arc. So she has this best friend who's an Australian who just looks up to her and likes her as a person and doesn't care about what she comes with. He just genuinely likes her as a human being. And that is utterly terrifying to her. So I really just wanted to explore when you have this crazy life where you are a symbol, where you are under the microscope, is it possible to have a love that is pure and unconditional, or do you need to make what is essentially a business arrangement between another person who can cope with the pressures of fame, who is in that world, who may not be your love match, but they would be a perfect business partner?
Before I let you go, Rebecca, I want to ask, this book, to me, it shows that so many people in the royal family have experienced so much pain, almost specifically because of this experience. And I wonder about whether there should be a royal family at all. I mean, is this model outdated in modern society?
Yeah, look, I think it's a really interesting question. And I'm fascinated to see what happens in the next 50 years, because I think, you know, long-standing institutions really have to justify their place in society, and people are asking questions about inherited power. So I'll be fascinated to see what happens. You know, I think if you look at the royal houses in Scandinavia, it's very common if you go to the Netherlands to see a princess riding a bike down the street. They call them bicycle monarchies for that reason, because they're very low-key. They try to keep it low cost. So those houses have evolved. The House of Windsor has not. So I'll be fascinated to see what Prince William does, because I think he's indicated that he wants to maybe pursue something a bit closer to a bicycle monarchy. So that might help with its survival. But, you know, I don't think there's any guarantees that there will be, you know, a constitutional role for a monarchy 20, 50 years from now.
Rebecca Armitage, her fantastic debut novel, The Heir Apparent, is out now. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been so lovely.
Where do you go after you've reached the top? It's a question more than 70 filmmakers have had to noodle on over the past century after winning a Best Director Oscar. I mean, how do you follow that up? Some want to astound us even more with their next act. Think of Alejandro González Iñárritu, who followed up his first Oscar for the backstage satire Birdman with the historical epic The Revenant.
I ain't afraid to die anymore. I done it already.
The Revenant was an even bigger box office hit and garnered him a second win for Best Director. Other times, Oscar-winning directors just want to lighten up. That was the case for the Coen brothers, who followed up their Best Directing win for the brooding No Country for Old Men with the silliness of Burn After Reading.
You have no idea what you're doing.
And I warn you.
You warn us. Fact. You warn us?
Yes. Yes.
You warn us?
Yes.
Let me tell you something, Mr. Intelligence.
We
warn you.
It is Oscar season, folks, and to discuss more on the films that directors make after they win the Best Director Oscar, I'm joined now by All Things Considered producer and our resident movie guy, Mark Rivers. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Miles.
And by freelance film critic Kyle Wilson, who writes a newsletter on Substack about this very theme called Oscar Chaser. Hi, Kyle.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so there are like a couple buckets, I feel like, that the Oscar chasers fall into, Kyle. Can you walk us through these different categories of the movies people make after they reach the top?
So sometimes there's these people who go off and they want to go and make like their big passion project that they've always wanted to make, like Peter Jackson doing King Kong after Lord of the Rings.
He was a king in the world he knew, but he comes to you now a captive. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Kong, the eighth wonder of the world!
And then there's like sort of these other directors, sort of you talked about the Coen brothers. We can talk about Bong Joon-ho for Parasite, who kind of like veer away from being like, I don't want to be this sort of like prestige best director. They go and they make these sort of like larks of movies like Burn After Reading or Mickey 17. Steven Soderbergh's another good example of that, of someone who like had his big Oscar moment and then went off and made like Ocean's 11.
What I'm about to propose to you is both highly lucrative and highly dangerous.
I think the movie that comes after that Oscar one can be very telling because it can kind of key us into what the priorities of the filmmaker is, you know, creatively, what kind of filmmaker they want to be.
Yeah,
you know?
What do you actually want,
yeah,
right?
And you mentioned Ocean's 11, Steven Soderbergh. It's a very, like, that is such a zag from the movie that he won for, Traffic, which is like this big important movie about this big important issue, you know, the global drug trade, right? And, you know, Soderbergh started out his career on the outside of the industry. You know, he was part of the kind of Sundance boom with this film, Sex, Lies, and Videotape. He was always kind of seen as an outsider. And I feel like Ocean's 11 was his way of kind of recovering that bit of himself, you know, and I think since then, he's done a lot more Ocean's 11s than he's done Traffic's.
But I do want to focus on the failures, whether box office wise or artistically. I guess the flops to me are in some ways more interesting because they are, in a lot of cases, seems like they're bigger risk. Like the director just, you know, had carte blanche and took a direction, a swing and a miss, for lack of a better term. Kyle, can you lay out some of the movies there that really stick out to you?
I mean, Kyle, you mentioned one already. You can elaborate on this, but I think Bong Joon-ho's Mickey 17 was a bit of a disappointment after the historic win of Parasite, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm kind of a Mickey 17 defender,
I'm sorry to say. All right.
Here's the thing. I'm never going to say no to a movie that has two Robert Pattinsons in it.
I don't like you. But I'm you. I'm not you. I'm not going to live like you.
So as much as I have my issues with Mark Ruffalo doing whatever he's doing in that and Toni Collette going on about
her sauces or whatever.
Sauce. Yeah. Yes.
So glad you seem to be enjoying it. How's the sauce?
So I'm a little bit of a defender of that movie, but like no doubt about it, it was a big disappointment. It was sort of meh received critically and obviously was a huge box office flop. I think that's a really interesting one because Parasite, it was such an exciting Oscar win. Obviously, Bong is like, has been a great filmmaker for a very long time, but like was never really someone who you'd ever expect to like really get that sort of Oscar moment. And I think the fact that it was like, what, 5 years, 5 or 6 years since Parasite, it just built this crazy anticipation.
Yeah, I feel like it gets at this kind of idea of it's really hard to live up to whatever it is. Parasite's the ultimate example of that because it's like considered one of the best movies of the last 30 years, right?
Right,
but I feel
like,
was it even possible for him to make a movie that would have fulfilled all of those expectations.
Probably not, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's both the expectations that he set for himself and also audience expectation. And I find that latter thing to be particularly interesting sometimes. And another kind of what might be called a financial failure that I would look to is Damien Chazelle's First Man. And this was the film that he made after winning the Oscar for La La Land. And I would even pair him with Barry Jenkins, who did not win Best Director for Moonlight, but he did win an Oscar for Moonlight. And they were kind of paired together, probably unfairly paired together. La La Land versus Moonlight back for a very specific reason.
Yeah.
But they both followed up those successes in 2018. Chazelle with First Man, which is about Neil Armstrong and getting to the moon.
Neil, if it does turn out, you'll go down in history. What kind of thoughts do you have about that when the thought hits you? Suppose that flight successful?
We're planning on that flight being successful.
And If Beale Street Could Talk, the James Baldwin adaptation.
I hope that nobody has ever had to look at anybody they love through glass.
And both of those movies got very muted reactions from audiences. And even critically, while they were both kind of acclaimed, there wasn't the same kind of euphoria, I felt like, around the films as there were around La La Land and Moonlight, even though I would say that First Man is Damien Chazelle's best movie to date.
Listen, you're speaking to the right guy here.
Oh, yes.
About that.
Good, good.
I am such a huge First Man fan. I think it is interesting to look at the Barry and Damien of it all. Cause yeah, I mean,
anointed as like the new generation of great American filmmakers.
Absolutely. And then Beale Street and First Man were just absent from that entire Oscar season, at least in like the best director sort of sense.
I want to shift gears to talk a little bit about the successes, the success stories as well, I guess. Are there movies, Kyle, that you think of that maybe haven't gotten the same critical acclaim as the wins for these people, but that you consider to be better movies?
I'm a big Spielberg nut. I know that that's mildly lame to say, but I do think AI is finally getting a bit of the critical reevaluation over the last like 10 or 15 years that I think it's long been deserved.
Yeah, so for listeners who don't know, this is AI, Artificial Intelligence, Spielberg's 2001 film, which was originally supposed to be a Stanley Kubrick film. He passed it along to Spielberg before he died. And AI was Spielberg's first film after Saving Private Ryan, which won him his second directing Oscar. And it depicts this futuristic kind of dystopian world where humans have created robots who look and behave like humans. And it stars Haley Joel Osment as this kid robot who wants to actually become a real boy.
They hate us, you know. The humans, they'll stop at nothing.
My mommy doesn't hate me because I'm special and unique.
AI kind of represents kind of the start of a really fascinating run of films for Spielberg, where I felt like, to me, that he was almost like subverting some of the tropes and ideas that he had established with classics like E.T. and Close Encounters, even Schindler's List. And I think, I think that run in the early thousands, where his films got more emotionally complicated and less tidy, I think you can trace, you know, films like Munich and War of the Worlds and Minority Report. I think that all starts with AI, Artificial Intelligence.
Absolutely. And I think now that we have had all those movies and we've realized that he's sort of nestled into getting a little darker and a little more moody, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
I think AI makes a lot more sense in that context. It's also a movie that has Jude Law playing a sex robot. So I'm...
And just the fact that there's even sex in a Spielberg movie was like...
I know. Where like else kind does of, that happen?
Yeah.
That's film critic Kyle Wilson. He writes a Substack called Oscar Chaser and NPR's Mark Rivers. I don't know what you guys are doing after this, but hopefully it follows up and you can live up to the high standards you set here.
That's all we can hope for. Thanks, Miles.
Thank you.
You've been listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Have a great rest of your Sunday.
Latino USA coming up next, along with an NPR News update. Support for NPR comes from Subaru. The Subaru Share the Love event runs through January 2nd. By year's end, Subaru and its retailers will have donated more than $350 million to charity. Subaru, more than a car company. And the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org and the listeners of KQED. Well, a couple hours ago, there was a multi-car crash in the, on the Dumbarton Bridge with a car fire and so forth. We're going to get an update now. It's been 2 hours. Joe Salvatore.
Yeah, Beth, actually, I think we're coming up on 3 hours on this crash eastbound on the Dumbarton Bridge, right around mid-span. At one point, all the lanes were blocked for about an hour. Now it's just the right lane that's shut down. But traffic still backed up towards University Avenue. In Walnut Creek, eastbound 24 at 680, it's a crash blocking the two left lanes. Joe Salvatore for KQED.
Okay, well, thank you, Joe. I stand corrected. Really a problem there, and we'll check in again with you soon. Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers. Announcing the Season of New Traditions events going on now at local Kia dealers, offering a selection of SUVs, sedans, and hybrids. More info at kia.com.
Scientists have discovered millions of new species on Earth since the 1700s, and we are averaging 17,000 more every year. But how many more are there?
The range of estimates of how many species are out there are from the low millions to the low trillions.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The mission to better understand life on our own planet, on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
That's tomorrow afternoon. You can check out the early edition at 1 and then all